Is it time for a mind shift? If you don't know what that means, then join your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, a former evangelical Christian pastor and Bible college teacher of over 20 years, along the journey of deconstruction and reconstruction of faith, life, religion, and spirituality.
Hey everybody, thanks for tuning in to another episode of Mindshift Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Dr. Clint Haycock. I am super excited to be bringing you this week's episode, an interview with my heroes, really, Flo Conway and Jim Siegelman. They are the authors of the books Snapping and Holy Terror, and we're going to be getting into both of those books. We're going to be talking about what does snapping actually mean, and they go into, from that, something they call information disease, and we're going to talk about that too. And then we're going to get into the book Holy Terror, which is really a fascinating study of the American Christian conservative fundamentalist, really, their rise to power. They wrote this book, it came out in 1982, and that's why I say they're really my heroes, because this is something that Chris Shelton and I talked about. And I was just going to say, before I go on into talking about Holy Terror, you want to check out the Sensibly Speaking podcast, because I've been on it once before. About a month ago, Chris and I did a chat on kind of my story, and then we started getting into this very topic that I'm going to be talking about with Conway and Siegelman in just a minute. This whole thing about what's going on currently in America today in terms of religious fundamentalism and their takeover, or I should say their attempted takeover of the American scene in terms of both combining religion and politics. And in fact, I think around the same time this episode drops, the one with Conway and Siegelman, the one that Chris and I did on his show, that's going to be available as well. And we get way more into this very topic and some of the current events that are going on around this. And so look for that. Check out the episode with me and Chris that's just dropping, as I say, right around the same time this one's going to be coming out. And so you can subscribe to the Sensibly Speaking podcast or Chris's YouTube channel. Now, what I want to talk about a little bit before we get into the episode with Conway and Siegelman, something that I was saying a minute ago about how they were some of the first investigators that began looking at this whole subject of how does this all work, because they were perfectly placed to start investigating this stuff back in the late 70s, early 1980s, and we're going to be talking about how that all came about in just a few minutes. But they say in their book, Holy Terror, right in the first couple of pages, they talk about this phenomenon that they were investigating and really what the book is all about. What is Holy Terror? And they say, quote, in the 80s, and keep in mind the book came out in 82, they say, in the 80s, America has given birth to a new form of terror, a campaign of fear and intimidation aimed at the hearts of millions. It is in two great American arenas, religion and politics, that this new terror has raised its head. They go on to say, in the past few years, a small group of preachers and political strategists has begun to use religion and all that Americans hold sacred to seize power across a broad spectrum of our lives. They say, they are exploiting this cherished and protected institution. Our most intimate values and individual beliefs, along with our civil religion, our love of country, in a concerted effort to transform our culture into one altogether different from the one we have known. And they conclude by saying, it is an adventurous thrust with cross and flag to pierce the heart of America without bloodshed. And it is already well underway, end quote. And that's the first page of Holy Terror. This is what they were investigating in the late 70s and early 80s. And that's what led them to write this book. They were just in the time of the Reagan years. People like Jerry Falwell Sr., the Moral Majority, the religious right, various fundamentalist sects and sort of cults in a way we could say, that were rising up specifically to motivate evangelical and Catholic voters to elect Ronald Reagan. And of course, what we're seeing now, I believe, with what's going on with Donald Trump and his very strong, if not blindly loyal, 81% white evangelical base, the same base that helped to get him elected and is still blindly loyal to him, like what I argue in my Medium article, a political cult leader. I think he's a political cult leader. He's got a cult of personality going. Now, they go on to say, and this is quite an interesting thing, they're describing what holy terror is, and they say, quote, "Yet there is an unspoken element to the fervor," that's the religious fervor they're talking about, "that has come upon the scene. It is the element of terror, the hidden factor of personal and political intimidation that has become a driving force in this new climate of change. It is a terror that speaks reverently of God and country, of traditional values, American morality, and the Judeo-Christian ethic, but it has little, if anything, to do with religion as we know it." They say, "It is no expression of faith or devotion, no act of patriotism or love for America. Instead, it is the exploitation of religion as the vehicle for a larger social and political movement, a drive for power, not only at the national level, but in every domain of public concern, in the most intimate areas of our private lives, and in the most volatile arena of world affairs. It is this broad program of intimidation, manipulation, and control in the name of religion that we call holy terror," end quote. And they're going to go on in the book to describe all the various interviews and meetings and research that they did with people that were both affected by holy terror. People who were affected by mass mailings and televangelists and evangelicalism and fundamentalism and into the political arena. And as I say, that trajectory that they were first picking up on in the late 70s, early 80s, that has not gone away. What's going on with Trump, that's not a blip. It's a feature. It's not a bug, as they say. That's what's going on. And it's been going on since the 80s, at least, if not before that. They just got mobilized then. So it's quite interesting when you start looking at things like Project Blitz and some other things that are going on right now, the recent anti-abortion laws. And we'll get into that also in this podcast with Conway and Siegelman. So there's some really interesting stuff. You need to be aware of this. This basically is the fundamentalist agenda that they picked up on in the early 80s, and we're still seeing it. In fact, it's even stronger in many ways to this very day. So be aware of what's going on. So let's go on into it. I want to get into my interview with Conway and Siegelman as we talk about snapping, information disease, and holy terror. I'm so glad to be joined by authors Flo Conway and Jim Siegelman. Thank you guys for being a part of Mindshift Podcast. You guys are really my heroes because of the work that you guys have done in both the books that I've read anyway so far. I've been devouring Holy Terror as well as your book Snapping. And these books are absolutely fantastic. Coming out of a background of religious fundamentalism myself, it was right up my alley. So thank you so much for being guests on the show.
It's our pleasure, Clint.
It's a definite pleasure to discuss both of these books together.
Yes, I think there's a definite correlation, at least as I've been reading Snapping. I was reading, in fact, your article, Information Disease, which I think came out in the early 80s. Must have been around the same time that Holy Terror came out. So I know we're going to get into Snapping and this issue of information disease. So can you explain what is Snapping? Because I know the book came out originally in the first edition. Was it 1978? It was just before the Jonestown tragedy. And yes. So what was this phenomenon that led you to investigate that? And of course, then the Jonestown tragedy occurs, and that kind of catapulted the book into a whole nother realm, didn't it?
Well, Flo and I we met at Harper's Magazine in New York in the mid-70s, and we both had our different interests. Flo had done her work in communication at the University of Oregon and was looking at human communication. I had studied philosophy at Harvard and at Trinity College, Cambridge, and my field was philosophy of mind. And coming at this from two opposite ends, historically and theoretically, we were watching these reports emerging of these kids who were going into cult groups, and then the kidnappings and deprogrammings that were being conducted by the pioneering deprogrammer, Ted Patrick. We're watching all this as media people and saying there's something going on here. And from both of our perspectives, we kept hearing this term. They said someone just snapped, or they were deprogrammed and snapped out of it. And this phenomenon is what drew our attention, because nobody had ever seen this, not in the literature and in the psychology or mental health, quite like what we were observing in the 70s.
Well, where we were situated when we decided that this is something that needed to be looked into. Jim said we were both at Harper's Magazine. We were part of a staff put together to bring back one of the old publications, Harper's Weekly, and it was a reader participation weekly. And in that process of doing that weekly and communicating with people all over the country, we saw so many things and things that we were hearing from the people out in the country about a wife who did this and went away and just disappeared, or children who were disappearing and they didn't know what was happening, and the parents, because they were very confused, they wouldn't mind if their children were finding some spiritual sustenance, but they weren't sure. And all these kinds of things were coming to us in our offices. And
all around us in New York, on the streets, you had Moonies, you had Hare Krishnas, you had recruiters for all the first cults in that wave in the 70s that seemed like very different from any of the different religious sects, even some of the cult-like ones that had come before, because they were seeing the ritual practices and changes that were so sudden and so dramatic that that's when we decided we were going to leave our jobs at Harper's and just go out together across the country and start talking to people and see what we could learn.
And you've certainly learned a lot. I know you were saying the book was well-placed in the sense that in that sort of coming out of that summer of love, late 60s, early 70s, in America especially, there's this huge cultural revolution, sexual revolution, and into this vacuum that, you know, they get the Vietnam War and all this stuff is going on. The country's tearing itself apart, really, politically and everything else. And here comes these Eastern cults and so forth. And like you say, they're suddenly just appearing on the streets, and what's going on? So it's a good thing you two, you know, were in that place at the right time to start studying this and really put your backgrounds to use. And so, yeah, it's a very prescient book, I think, especially as well as Holy Terror, because it's, you're seeing things, what, 30, 40 years ago almost now, that are all kind of, the trajectory is still going on today.
Exactly.
And things we feared and patterns we saw beginning to emerge.
Exactly.
Not only among the extremist cults and the esoteric cults, but among the Bible cults. And when the religious right and the evangelical movement joined forces and began to enter the political arena in 1980, that's when we saw that this was now shifting into a much larger world with incredible potential consequences that we're only now seeing coming
exactly.
to fruition.
We're seeing it now. Well, let's take a look at your own definition. I'm going to quote from your own book, Snapping. You say that snapping is kind of a broad term. It's, quote, any sudden drastic alteration of personality in all its many forms. Like you say, it's a sudden alteration. Your personality has kind of snapped. A new person appears. And the way I looked at it was when I read that definition, I thought, oh, coming out of fundamentalism and evangelicalism, that's a description of the dramatic conversion experiences in a church setting. But you could relate that to cults as well, can't you?
Yes, absolutely. The whole recruitment process in cults, that we studied the major fundamental cults that were on the scene in the 70s, and just the recruitment process, the way it went. And a lot of times it was led by a friend or a family member. But it was also the time, as you mentioned, in the 60s, when people were in search of new experiences. They were in search of deeper, of new meanings and deeper meanings. And yes, when they would be recruited and everything would be look just fine when they came in, and then the rituals began. One was in the Moonies, where they started keeping them up all night, or they'd have them playing volleyball in the middle of the night or something like that. But in each group, it started happening once they had brought them into wherever they were, a church, a compound.
And what we noticed, Clint, why these cults were such extraordinary microcosms to study the process of personality change, was because what we noticed were similar patterns in all these new cults. And you could see in microcosm the way these changes were being systematically engineered. Mm-hmm. Now, the cults didn't say that, although some, like Scientology, claim to be using scientific methods for self-help and self-improvement. But the other cults all had their own jargon. They were trying to engineer, at that time, in the 70s, what everybody was looking for, a life-changing personal experience, a moment of transcendence or revelation. revelation or an encounter with God. So each cult had its own language, but they were using group rituals, they were using hypnotic techniques, they were using what we really homed in on, which were these ongoing mind-stilling rituals, whether they were meditation or chanting of mantras in the Eastern sects, whether it was something they called centering in the Moonies. And in the Bible sects, we saw them centering through memory, scripture memorization, and through speaking in tongues in the charismatic sects. And in each case, people would report having these sudden, overwhelming spiritual experiences. And at that point, from what we saw, people would then be incredibly vulnerable after they experienced what we call this snapping moment. Their minds would just be like putty. They would be wide open for suggestion and command and just the input of all kinds of indoctrination and belief systems that they would now be so receptive to.
It is fascinating, isn't it? Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating. What were you going to say, Flo?
Well, and in our study, we did the first and largest North American study of these groups. And one of the things that we found was a two-pronged system of control. How does this work? Well, the social part of it, there's the group dynamic, there's the group part of it, or, you know, just the, as you know, the church part of it, or whatever is happening with the group. And then there's the systematic thing, whether it's a mantra, whether it's the speaking in tongues, whether it's whatever it is that is internalized by the individual. And it's that internalization and what we were told so often, like the people who would come out of these Bible cults, so if speaking in tongues, they would say, speak in tongues all the time. And they could not break the rhythm in their heads. Some would say it's like you hear a song and you can't get it out of your head. You can't. It goes and goes and goes. And so the inner dynamic of that control was the second prong of this control system.
I relate it to my background in fundamentalist and evangelical Christianity. I did a podcast on the psychology of conversion, and I use Robert Lifton's sort of 8 markers of cults and how they do psychologically are able to utilize mind control techniques. Now, I hadn't read Snapping yet. Now I kind of wish I had read it before I did that podcast, because it really fits in with what I was talking about based on Lifton's work, the idea that groups put so much psychological pressure on the proposed convert or the recruit that you say, as you say in your words, they finally snap. They have that sort of conversion moment or whatever you want to call it. And mm-hmm. What Lifton calls it is doubling. It's almost a new person comes out from inside the old one. There's the cult personality or the religious personality. And now you've got two people sort of living side by side. The other one is a new one. And then, as you say, they're left in a state of suggestibility. And that must be where you get into this information disease, because it seems like reading in the article, especially once you've snapped, now you're open to the information indoctrination from the group. And it literally is just a process over time that actually it's a neurological thing, isn't it? It actually does something to the person neurologically.
Yeah, that was the real discovery in this study we did. We studied 400 former members of 48 different cults and self-help therapies and extremist groups in the U.S. and Canada. And when we took that whole body of data and side by side, and we took it to the University of Oregon and did the most thorough and statistical analysis that's ever been done on this, and that's exactly what we found, was that over time, these repetitive rituals, these internalized mind-stilling rituals, over time have an organic effect. And that's what we had to call information disease. It was literally impairing or making captive, and in the worst cases, damaging the people's basic capacities to think, to feel, to make choices, independent choices. And as Flo was saying, the people in our study sometimes took months and up to 12 years for a former Scientologist to recover from these organic effects. And that's where Lifton's work is really epical. He was really observing this going back to the first appearance of what they call brainwashing in China and North Korea during the Korean War. But Lifton's model really was based on coercion. Most of the Korean and Chinese methods, thought reform methods, and that they used on prisoners of war, that captured airmen, those were really coercive methods. And what we noted about the cults of the West, in America especially, nobody was being coerced to join these cults. Mm-hmm. They were being persuaded, but it was covert. They weren't being told what they were getting into. There were different languages and terms for all the rituals and practices. And only then, after they were so deeply immersed, would they realize what life in the cult was like and be exploited in countless ways by their leaders. And our whole model is based on communication and forms of what we call covert induction, where people are brought into these sects, recruited covertly by deception and all kinds of other means. And then these internalized rituals are the ones that keep them in the group so that you don't have to have physical coercion.
We also knew along the way that this was the perfect kind of control system to advance into a democracy, that you could not do it on the terms of, let's say, Lifton's model. You really could not do it here that way. But in the United States, in any democracy, it is in these covert ways and these covert methods that are riding on all different uses of information and messages, distortion of messages, distortion of the facts, distortion of things, and manipulation.
Yeah, that's the issue, isn't it? And I know Lifton, he does obviously go on into cult formation, and he talks about in the last chapter or so of his book, he gets into the psychology of cults. And I think where he started realizing it was, yes, as you say, brainwashing technically is more about physical coercion, isn't it? You're put, yes, in a jail cell, and you might be, yeah, beaten, and you might be starved, and, you, yes, know, whipped, and all these terrible things. You're not seeing that in a church or even in Scientology. You're just coming in off the street and, hey, here's a free auditing session. It's a free counseling session. Get in touch with yourself. And like you say, there's a lot of indirection that you never know what the group is actually about. Just come to this self-help therapy session after work. It's going to be, you know, at a hotel downtown, but it's a front for a cult. And so you got to be so careful to know what it is you're getting yourself into. And I think, you know, this is how cults get people, isn't it? They're very, very sneaky, very deceptive, as well as Christian churches as well. I know that's another that's another thing I'm sure we'll get into.
Well, it's a come on with a smile.
And exactly.
Come on with, you know, you are just so beautiful. You're just so handsome. You're just so smart, or something on that order. And it always is like that. And it's a soft underbelly. And where the controls are happening, unless they are instructed, unless people are educated and understand this new level of use of communication and deception of information and all of that, they're, as you have said many times in your other podcasts, they're so vulnerable, because people come to these groups because there's some vulnerability in us. And people have always said, oh, well, that will never happen to me, da 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 da. And it is the fact that if you're a human being, you're vulnerable to this kind of stuff.
Exactly. And what I found interesting, especially in your article, Information Disease, you say, here's another quote. It says, quote, "The psychological trauma cults inflict upon their members is directly related to the amount of time spent in indoctrination and mind control techniques." Mm-hmm. And so this neurological pathway, and you say that actually Christian-based cults report the highest average hours per week in ritual indoctrination. So you say you've got tongues and chanting and prayers, and you're hearing sermons and Bible studies. And actually, that has a long-range effect on the person. As you say, once they get out of the group, it takes a long time to recover and rebuild and reconstruct, because it's actually done neurological damage to your brain. You don't think of it that way. You're just saying a prayer. But it's actually imprinting itself somehow on your psychology as well as your brain.
And that somehow is over hundreds and ultimately maybe thousands of hours of repetition.
This is why I find this topic of information disease so incredibly fascinating. The average person's not going to experience this in one or two meetings with the group, are they? We're talking about years and years of chanting, indoctrination, tongues, whatever the mantras are. That is what actually brings about the information disease.
The Hare Krishna did this with their Hare Krishna mantra. You would do it. They did it in our study. We found up to 7 hours per day. In the Way International, which was one of the major Christian Bible cults in the 70s, they told their members to speak in tongues much, and they were doing it. So it became a subvocal chant that was going on under subvocally around the clock for them, even when they would be sleeping or then wake up. And when we met some of these kids and when we surveyed them, we found that they could not break the rhythm. It took sometimes between a year and a half and 2 years on average for people to break those repetitive rhythms that they had internalized from each of the different cult practices.
And then when you put that kind of difficulty together with, and especially in fundamentalist Christian groups, is that you have the social community. You have that elongated thing of the church and the community and all of that. And that makes it even, and that's another very difficult kind of conflict. And it just is like a vice-like thing with that internal thing that goes on.
Exactly. And it's very difficult for people to leave both churches as well as cults for a whole variety of reasons. Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned fundamentalism. Maybe we can kind of transition a little bit, because I'm looking in your book, Snapping, and you do talk about, you raise the subject or the question, is evangelicalism, is it a cult? And at first, I remember there's a section in one of the chapters that says, you know, on the face of it, the answer would be, of course not. It's not a cult. I mean, people aren't, you know, put in cages. They're not beaten. They're not starved. They're not indoctrinated like in these Chinese communist prisons. But actually, if you look at it a bit more closely, there's a lot of cult tactics, and people do cut relationships off with friends and family when they get into the church bubble, and they're susceptible to this indoctrination, and there's that fundamentalist message. So there's got to be a connection, I would hope, between snapping and holy terror. I'm not sure how you would put those two together.
Well, there is what we said in Holy Terror, where we're looking at the movement of the religious right into the political arena. Is evangelicalism, is American fundamentalism a cult? The quick answer is it can't be. It's just too big.
It's too diverse.
That's not being flippant. It's not only diverse, but because it is so closely connected to the mainstream faith of American culture and throughout American history, it's very hard for people to make the distinction if they're looking from the outside, and it's even hard for people to make the distinction when they're inside or trying to leave. It's why we found it so difficult for fundamentalists to leave their sects and their Bible cults, because they came out into a world that was just reverberating with so much that they had been taught and schooled in inside.
Mm-hmm. So that they walk out and, you know, they see the devil everywhere. And,
he's everywhere. Yeah, yeah. Satan's everywhere. He's under every rock. But that's a classic cult tactic, isn't it? It's to instill phobias into the followers such that they are afraid to leave. And that's one way to keep them in. If you go out into the world, Satan's out there. Satan's going to get you. You know, and so, yeah, they've got all these phobias, and you're going to go to hell, and you're going to lose your salvation. These are terrifying things. So there's holy terror right there, not even getting into the political arena.
And that's one of the things about our work, and that is the earlier models, Lifton and some of the others, they'll talk about phobias, and they'll talk about thought-terminating cliches or doubling of personalities. This is where what we found in our work and what our study really did show up in statistical confirmation, and why we put the whole study and the statistical profile in the second edition, which came out in 1995, because we want people to have all the data. What we saw there was that these were not just phobias and fears, they were systematically ingrained. We met kids who'd been in Bible culture, came out and said they literally hallucinated Satan. When they were out in the world, they would literally see the devil perched on the shoulders of anybody who would question their faith or question their participation in the group. And these were the kind of organic effects on their basic capacities of mind, hallucinations and delusions and these ongoing repetitions and what they called floating in and out of these altered states that were systematically instilled. I know that one of the biggest evangelical groups in the country and the world really then, and it's still pretty active under a different name, was Campus Crusade for Christ.
Bill Bright.
Bill Bright's group, and Bill Bright's literature, you can see it on their website today. They called for what we noticed was a call to surrender, which was a covert mode of hypnotic induction or a covert form of inducing these snapping experiences. They put it in the language of how to be saved and how to find a new life in Christ. But Bill Bright said the key to being born again is the surrender of the will, the mind, the emotions, the entire person. And that's literally what a lot of these kids did. And if you look at Campus Crusades rituals, which were similar to others, but they were just explicit, like an open book. They had one that said, do not depend on feelings. And they had mind-stealing rituals and emotion-stealing rituals. And we saw this across the evangelical spectrum. The devil is a doubt bringer. So anytime you doubted or questioned your participation in a group or any aspect of your faith, these images of the devil would come to mind. And those are powerful internal communication controls that can affect people organically. And it's not just a doubling of personality, but over time we see that their own personalities are impaired and damaged organically. That's why it takes so long for people to come back from some of these groups.
Yeah, so going on into Holy Terror, well, there's obviously a connection between the recruitment tactics as well as the indoctrination once you get in to, let's say, your fundamentalist church or Bible cult. But what led you to start investigating that specific phenomenon? Okay, you talk about in the book, you say that there was this sort of a surge of fundamentalism after Barry Goldwater failed to win the presidency, and that's where you get guys like Jerry Falwell Sr., the Moral Majority. Were you seeing the trends back in the late 70s, early 80s that you were getting alarmed by? Is that what led you to investigate this phenomenon?
Well, actually, we saw more than that, because after Jonestown was a real watershed, because there were so many parents, there were so many families, and so many kids that had gone here, there, and everywhere into so many different kinds of groups. And Jonestown was brought the parents and the authorities in different states and also federally into an acknowledgement that there is something very, very wrong going on here. So we were out there a lot, and we were speaking in a lot of places. And what started to happen was, and this was like right around 1979, we would finish our addresses that we were doing on the cult phenomenon. When the people would start breaking up, we would have this huge groups of people waiting in the wings off the stage or down waiting for us as we were leaving. And they would come to us and they would say, oh, can you help us? Can you help us? And what they were telling us about were changes that were taking place in their churches they had belonged to for a long time, their parents had belonged to, and changes in their children who were now going to some of these groups who were offshoots of the churches. And what it was doing also was dividing families. Children were splitting themselves off from their parents because they didn't believe this or that. And that's how we started to see this. And so we started investigating it, and that's when we decided, no, this is really important.
And when we saw this whole movement become politicized and jump into the political arena with the 1980 election, we knew that this was very ominous, because we saw all the same communication and control tactics that we had seen in the cults. Mm-hmm. And it was in 1980 that we learned, 1980, 81, that we began our research for Holy Terror after Ronald Reagan was elected. And we learned about how this new right political movement in the Republican Party was joining forces, making common cause with evangelical pastors and fundamentalist preachers who historically had not been active politically. But the new right political strategists did their polling and their focus groups, and they identified the born-again Christians in America as the largest block of unregistered voters that they could target. And they saw that you couldn't move this block of people on matters of the economy or in world affairs because they weren't interested. They were living in the world of a Bible-based belief system. But if you targeted them on the single issue of abortion, that you could mobilize these people, they would give money, they would organize grassroots level campaigns, and they would jump into this arena and register and vote. And that's exactly how the religious right began in 1980, and that's exactly what is culminating today in the movement of the anti-abortion groups and anti-abortion laws all across the country.
Exactly. I was going to say, with all these spate of recent anti-abortion laws and mostly, well, I wouldn't say all, they're not all southern states, are they? Because you have Ohio well. But all of a sudden, there's just been one after the other, after the other, after the other. They've been emboldened to pass these laws. Okay, they think, well, they may get struck down in the courts, but it seems like they're testing what they can do. They're obviously trying to overturn Roe versus Wade. But as you say, when I read Holy Terror, I'm seeing this movement too, because when I was a kid growing up, I mean, I remember going to see Ronald Reagan in Seattle in his second candidacy when he was running for re-election. So, you know, that was right around that same era. It seems like people over here in Britain, they say, well, Donald Trump, he's an anomaly. And I said, no. That trajectory that was started back in those days in the late 70s, early 80s, to me, as I see it, is just a continuation of the white evangelical base that helped elect Trump and continues to support him. That's not a blip. That's a long-standing thing over the course of several decades. It seems like to me anyway, looking at it from the outside anyway.
No, that is exactly true. Because we've been watching the same thing. And we've seen it. We've seen it in every election. We've seen it more. And the testing power, as you say, they're trying to test the courts. But we have seen this in relation to their goals. I mean, and when we were researching Holy Terror, they were very much, when Ronald Reagan was elected, they were very much chest pounding, a lot of them. And they were saying how they had, they told us what their goals were. The first one was to take over one of the major political parties. The second one was to take both houses of Congress, one at a time or both, whatever. Then the White House, the Supreme Court. And it's like they have, this is what we heard 40 years ago. So this is, of course, what has now come to fruition. But what the other thing that we have been very much aware of that has been going on now, you do not hear anything about evangelical, Bible-based, fundamentalist Christians in relation to what they call Donald Trump's base. You never hear the media, you never hear anyone use those terms.
I don't know if you notice it and how much of a news flow you're getting in the UK, but it struck us in the beginning, in the 80s, it was a very out front movement because they were, as Flo said, they were chest pounding about their great triumph with Ronald Reagan's election. And they laid all their cards on the table. But during that same period, the religious right, the Republicans, they all targeted the media and with claims that there were persecuting Christians and that media people were secular humanists and atheists who were out to attack Christianity. And the intimidating force that had on our colleagues in the media was something we saw and we could feel.
Oh, yes.
When Holy Terror came out,
campaigns.
We would go into radio stations and television studios and people would say, oh, we can't put you on the air, not in this community. And we saw, and they said that we just make too much money from these televangelists, or you're going to upset the housewives in our audience too much. But now what you've seen is this whole debate over abortion, we have not heard the word Christian or born-again evangelical Christians linked to it at all. It's just the so-called Republican base. It's always in quotes. And
exactly.
The base is the new code word that the media have all accepted and that everyone's doing so that they don't look like they're singling out the born-again Christian component. But what's happened is, just as you know from your time in evangelicalism, the degree to which born-agains have been surrendered and been drawn into these movements at the command of their preachers or at the command of these national organizations is still what's driving the Republican base. It's what put and keeps Donald Trump in office. And the Republican Party will do nothing but give them domestic policy successes so that they stay on board. Without them, there would be no Donald Trump. There wouldn't even be a Republican majority in this country.
But now when you put those things together with the base, as far as Christian fundamentalists or religious right fundamentalists, and you put it together with a real cult of personality, which is what we have, and maybe even a little bit of information disease, this combination of factors, all based on the same sets of control systems that we have found both in Holy Terror and in Snapping. And in Holy Terror, we brought forward for the first time the whole issue of emotional control. In the cull phenomenon in snapping, we were not dealing with that very much in the cult. But when we were dealing with holy terror, that very much was one of the things that we found in relation to the fundamentalist Bible-based Christian was emotional control.
You, like you say, you put those connections together, not just, and you, to me, you've got to zoom out. One thing that struck me about reading Holy Terror, you're putting your finger on things back in the early 1980s. I came across a quote that said that back in 1982, when you wrote the book, their objectives were the following. They said, or you said, they wanted to Christianize the nation. They wanted to fill all government positions with Bible-believing Christians. So you've got like a dominion reconstructionist theology, to gain ascendancy over the national media. So you could put Fox News, televangelist, whoever, to have fundamentalist beliefs taught as science in public schools. And we're seeing a resurgence of that, fighting evolution, to dictate the meaning of human life, which is abortion. And finally, to convert every person on earth. And what really struck me about Holy Terror was like this issue of missions, worldwide missions, because you bring the point out that actually the missions movement is about, it's about converting every single person in the world. It's not just an American thing. No, it's a worldwide campaign to go against folk religions and other religions in other places and replace it with their version of Christianity.
Exactly. And that's where, once again, Campus Crusade was just so open about those goals. We went to their headquarters. We interviewed their leading officials. And we looked at all of their documentation and all of their literature. And they stated it, come help change the world. And the goal was to convert every man, woman, and child on earth. And then, and now you've seen this replicated in hundreds, maybe thousands of American-based and global evangelical groups that are really aiming to do that. We have in Holy Terror, we managed to get through a confidential source a copy of their international employment job offers. And so many of those jobs all around the world were for young missionaries and young campus crusaders to try to convert or to bring into the fold people in the military, people in governments all over the world. And we just have it all printed there. That wasn't all public knowledge.
We got literally it. Black and white.
The idea that they go in and they go in like an intelligence operation, a covert operations, you know, to put people in the right place, the head of a country, to put them in their office or to put them in the right place in the military or something like that.
It's unbelievable. And that's the thing. I came across it when I was in Africa. I was over there when I was still a Christian in 2001. We went to Kenya in Nairobi. And what was really surprising, I guess I shouldn't have been surprised, but it was still surprising when we talked to the locals in Kenya, because we were part of a church group. Their theology was straight American Western fundamentalist Christianity. And I'm thinking, what? How, where is this coming from? And as we talked, it was clear that, well, of course, it made perfect sense because their theology was informed by Western missionaries in Kenya. You know, so it's right all over the world.
And those crusades were funded by very rich American evangelicals, many of whom were the heads of major corporations or tied into political organizations.
Exactly.
And they gave people like Nelson Bunker Hunt from the Hunt family, they gave literally millions of dollars for this purpose of trying to change the world as they saw it.
Yes. Yeah, take over the world. Well, where is it all going? I guess that's my question. You know, there we can see, yes, it's not just an American phenomenon. It's a worldwide thing. It is, it's obviously politically they're looking to get a toehold, and they have done certainly more than a toehold in American politics. And that's what's so strange about looking, you know, talking to my British friends here. We don't have that sort of church and state relationship. There is a state church here, of course, but it's nothing like the American context where you see the church so heavily involved in the state in America. You know, where are they trying to take this thing? Where do they want to take it?
Well, I think that that's where you have to really, as you say, back up far, because then you have to see, okay, in the United States, we have this, you know, the use of religion and politics as this vice control over things and what we've been talking about. But if you look at England and you look at other countries who do not have the religious component, what in that culture is the equivalent, has the equivalent kind of emotional controls, has the equivalent kind of controls over the experience, the using the British experience to control them or something like that. There, the equivalent exists in every culture.
And I think that's where we're seeing these nationalist movements. And there's large components of xenophobia and also racism and ethnic prejudices, because other countries, unlike the U.S., we're a polyglot nation, we're a melting pot. But the other countries are turning to their own cultural roots, their historical roots, their own indigenous ethnic groups that have become dominant in the population, so they can use outsiders as their scapegoats, and they can use them politically and use nationalism, as we've seen in the UK and other parts of Europe now. But the US, here we have church-state separation enshrined in our Constitution and Bill of Rights. But these groups have found ways, informally, covertly, and even through the courts, to be able to breach the wall of separation between church and state. Mm-hmm. In other countries where they don't have such an explicit protections, you see the same movements taking force everywhere. In Israel, Netanyahu and his party have joined forces with ultra-Orthodox Jews. In the Arab world, you've seen groups like Erdogan in Turkey, who has joined forces with fundamentalist Christians in the rural areas of Turkey to take control there. It's even awesome. Vladimir Putin, coming out of the Soviet Union's mm-hmm. atheistic history, has joined forces with the Russian Orthodox Church. So you see these same common bonds being formed, and you see a guy like Trump who will make common cause with all these aspiring authoritarians, and all of whom are relying on religion in a way that we did not see in the post-war era.
And a point that was made by Roger Cohen in the New York Times today about Boris Johnson, who looks like he may become your new prime minister. I'm not sure over there.
If Trump has his way, he will, I guess.
But one of the things that Roger Cohen said that really hit me right in the middle of the eyeballs was the fact that Johnson is also has this narcissistic kind of personality, this narcissistic element where he has always wanted more and more and more flattery and more this. I mean, in the sense, just like Trump, this narcissistic personality that really can become what we see here, a cult of personality, but a narcissism that has led Trump to so many criminal and corrupt operations, and to denigrate people, and to do the worst things in relation to our immigrants. Never in this nation's history has any president treated immigrants like this president is treating them and what they are doing on our southern borders. So that's where some of these characteristics that Roger Cohen was talking about went, uh-oh.
And Cohen, right, he also alarmed. He also said that both Trump and Johnson are masters of the dark arts.
Yes.
And by that, we know that means communication, control, propaganda, deception, and all the things that we saw in the microcosm of the cults that are now spreading in the macrocosm of all of the Western open societies and the democratic nations that have people, their demagogues have found that this is something they can ride to power. And so far, the Western democracies have really proved powerless to stop this, because the overflow of media, of propaganda, and the role of the internet, of course, has given this a force that we have never seen before, where people can go directly to vast audiences and put anything out there, and it can penetrate in ways that mass media never has before.
And that seems to me that's one of the critical differences that we're seeing now between when U2 wrote Snapping and Holy Terror. We have now the global internet. It's the mass media tool. We didn't have that 40 years ago. Well, when you wrote Holy Terror, the internet didn't exist. All they could rely on was literally mass mailing. They had to physically mail newsletters and letters to people on that. That was the critical thing. What I got from your book was that it was Paul Weyrich, I think it was, who had that master mailing list of every sort of fundamentalist or evangelical Christian in America. And everybody wanted that. They wanted that mailing list because that was that block that they built that we're still seeing today.
Right. And Richard Viguier, he was the
that was the one. Yeah.
He was the, what was the called? I can't even remember the terms.
But, you know, And that was so powerful because when you're working through what we call the black marketplace of ideas, it was closed channel. And the Democrats and other politicians could not see what was going out, where it was going, what was in these mailings. But they all Vigore had to do was push a button in his offices in Virginia, and this would go out to 30 or 40 million Christians. If you remember the Iran-Contra hearings in Congress when Reagan and the religious right,
Oliver North and all that,
deals to get money from the Middle East and to use this to fund movements, anti-communist movements and pro-right-wing movements in Central America. Oliver North had a famous day when he testified before the congressional committees, and somebody in Virginia pushed a button on their computers, and then you saw Oliver North sitting there the next day with 35,000 telegrams that he claimed were all supporting his side of the debate. And that's the power they had when nobody else could counter that. The Democrats, even the mainstream media, didn't have that kind of technology.
I think one of the things that we do introduce in Holy Terror, there are a lot of really important concepts and descriptions that we introduce in that book. And one of them that I believe is really valuable for trying to understand today a lot of the pieces of ideology that it is absolutely tearing nations apart. Different ideologies, they may not look like they're from a religion, or they may not look this way or that way. They're political ideologies or this kind of ideology, that. And one of the terms we introduced in Holy Terror that really does describe the way it all comes together. And then when you have somebody like Trump, who is a tyrant in the wings waiting, is ideological fundamentalism. Because it's fundamentalism, the ideologies become fundamentalism just in the sense of their absoluteness and the fact that it's them against us or this or that, but it's so narrow. And ideological fundamentalism does describe the large-scale number of ideologies now that are being pulled together by one leader or another.
Obviously, the world has become a whole lot more complex, and technology has speeded up all the processes of life. And not too many people have got the tools to crack this kind of complexity. When we watched the debate over Brexit and the EU, we've spent a lot of time in Europe over the last decade, and we can see even the leaders of European nations, they are resorting to things like austerity campaigns that are so simplistic and so absolute. It's clear that these people do not have the capacity to really grasp the complexities of the systems that they are controlling. And we see this at the mainstream level, we see it at the governmental level, and we see it down in every population. That's why absolute answers, whether it's a cult, whether it's an absolute literal interpretation of the Bible, whether it's an absolute embrace of the of free market fundamentalism, as they even call it, or Second Amendment in the U.S., the gun lobby, we call it gun fundamentalism.
These people, exactly, the NRA.
Answers, absolute answers to very complex questions, mm-hmm. and then they say that does it, and they don't think or question any more than that.
You don't need to think. Yeah, reduce it to black and white categories. Well, this is my question, is what does a person do, the average Joe or Susie citizen, as it were, because these things you're describing are huge problems. I mean, you've got, like you say, nationalism here in the UK. You've got groups like UKIP and the BNP. You've got far-right groups in France and Germany and Greece and places like that, where it's almost like there's a resurgence of Nazism, even in places like Poland, Eastern Europe. You know, Russia, like you said, it's very frightening. And I'm just a person. What can I do to stop any of it, to do anything about it? Just bury my head in the sand and hope that the politicians work it all out? I mean, what can average people do to make any difference?
One of the things that's really shocking to me here in the U.S., and I think this probably would apply to other European populations as well. What's shocking to me is the absolute ignorance of young people today, and so many people, of their history, of what it is and where this stuff come from. It's like they have no real understanding or knowledge of their own history. And that's one of the things that I think everybody needs to do. They need to go and understand where these things are coming from. They need to understand what happened in the Second World War. For example, the fact that Hitler, there was just a poll taken, and here the young people really thought that Hitler took power in Germany out of force. The fact that he was elected, you know, and it exactly. was like that they had no knowledge of any of that. And I think the other thing is that, as we were saying, that when people like simple answers, we heard this when we were investigating the cults in the 70s, that people would say, well, if it's black and white, if it's good, go this way, you know. And if, and you can't do that anymore. Things are too complex. And no matter how much people don't like complexity, you can't solve it by too much simplicity either.
And I think, Clint, what's really crucial is what you're doing and people and what you call the ex-evangelicals. I think it is so important for people to speak out and talk about your experiences and make the connections that you are making and other people are making.
Yes.
You know, it's really astounding to us. Back in the early 80s, after Jonestown and when the religious right first surfaced, we did a lot of shows when Holy Terror came out, when people would come out of evangelical sects because they would see us on TV and the light bulb would go on and people would make their way out and then they would talk and bring others out. And they would come to understand what had happened to them inside their sects. A decade ago, during the George Bush era, we did another national research tour to some of the places where there were huge mega churches in southern Ohio and in Colorado, around Colorado Springs, and talked to people in those groups and people who had come out of them. And we were amazed that people had no understanding of what the dynamics of these groups were. Even when they came out, they were what we call walkaways, and they were nowhere they could go because the deprogramming process that was so powerful to help the early cult members get out and understand what had happened to them had pretty much been ruled out by the courts in the Reagan era. So people did not have someplace they could go for to really understand what hit them. And a lot of psychologists and social workers didn't understand the dynamics either. So that's why people like yourself and ex-evangelicals to come out to make the connections like you've made in that great link you sent us about Trump's cult of personality.
Yes.
You can identify this and help people understand from your own experience what's going down today and in much broader social arenas.
That's what I'm learning. Yeah.
And it's also having people who want to come out of something, people who have doubts or something, you know, read books. Don't just read, you know, the thing on the bestseller list about Trump or, you know, whoever
the
it
Trump
is.
Trump prophecy?
Yeah, right.
Don't read the Trump prophecy.
but read books that analyze things. Read books that have something to say and some prescription. The other thing is don't normalize these times where what is happening all over the world, as you say, it looks like a return to Nazism. I mean, we saw that here in Virginia, the Nazi salute and the...
Charlottesville. The whole thing,
Yes, in Charlottesville. And it's don't normalize this. The British should never normalize what's happening to their country. And no country should normalize it if you want freedom and a democracy.
But that's where, you know, we're living in an information age, a global technological age. And the power of this age is not matter and energy. And let's hope it doesn't come down to atomic bombs. But information is what is going around this world every day and going into people and affecting them in ways that many of them never even suspect.
Yes.
That's why we take a communication approach to all these dynamics. And hopefully, if people educate themselves, if they speak out about their own experiences, that's probably the best way to really reach other people and help them understand what they're all being affected by every day.
Absolutely. Yeah, education is critically important. And going back to your point, Flo, what you said about Hitler, for example, I'm not the only one who's, I saw the connections, but I've read articles as well where people said, hey, what Trump, when he was a candidate, what Trump is doing was exactly the same sort of tactics that Hitler used to come to power.
You know, yes.
The populist message, the scapegoating of certain minority groups and so forth, ethnic groups and things, appealing to the rage and anger of a certain base, that this return to a golden era, which never really existed, but it makes a great trope in his message. The rhetorical strategies that he was using were exactly the same or very similar to what Hitler did. So you have to know your history for
absolutely.
Sure, don't you? It's absolutely critical.
And here, I mean, in what you see, lies, 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 lies.
Fire hose of lies.
And what did Hitler do? The big lie.
Exactly.
You know?
The bigger the lie, the more they're going to believe it. Isn't that what Joseph Goebbels said? Something like that.
Yep. That's
the more
right.
outrageous the lie.
In those days, information moved more slowly, and Hitler's big lie could carry him through two decades of power to the disaster that that Germany became. But Trump can keep this up through this fire hose of Twitter and through all of the media coming fast and furious every day, and the media cannot even keep up trying to expose these lies and counter them. And Trump is a master of that.
He really is, and it's that's why I say in my article about the personality cult of Donald Trump. That's when I made the connection. When I started reading people like Lifton and Holy Terror and other books, the light bulb started coming on. I'm like, well, my God. And of course, I'm not the only person. There's many other articles that I found on the cult of Trump. And he's basically turned the Republican Party into his party. It's the party of Trump, isn't it? It's a political suicide to go against him now if you're a Republican. Well, we see this Amash. He's in all kinds of trouble, isn't he, for saying the first Republican to step up and say, we should impeach Donald Trump, and they're vilifying him, you know, their own party's turning against him.
But his own constituents have given him standing ovations when he...
Yeah, I saw that the other day. He did a town hall meeting, didn't he? He actually got applauded for saying that.
Your article was really good, and it was important, and we've seen these references, and we've had so many inquiries about it. But one of the things we're looking at that we haven't seen anyone bring forward in this notion of Trump's cult of personalities are, again, the covert communication techniques and controls that he is using both in his inner circle, in the Republican Party, and Republicans in Congress, and in his great rallies. One of the things he has done that has been pretty clear, he has asked everybody to pledge their loyalty to him. And one of the controls we've looked at in evangelicalism and in the right wing in America are these pledges and loyalty oaths. You've had all kinds of pledges, whether they're abstinence pledges or whether they're
purity pledges.
Anti-tax, no tax pledges. But Trump demands loyalty to himself. And people have to understand how an oath works. If you're an office holder and you take an oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States, then you're making a commitment that's explicit, you know what you're doing, and it has a purpose. When Trump asks people to pledge loyalty to him, or these people use these covert code words to get people to swear oaths, they are internalized. They go into people, and they control them. The other thing that Trump has been using is public testimonials. And as a former evangelical, you will know the role of testimony.
Oh, it's absolutely.
Not to proselytize and bring others into the fold, it's also to reinforce your own beliefs and still your own doubts.
Yeah,
and Trump's
absolutely.
Administration and cabinet members are called to give testimony. We've seen it time and again on the evening news, to give testimony to how wonderful Donald Trump is. And it becomes an ongoing control that spreads through the whole culture.
And you're in the information disease then at that point, aren't you?
Yes.
I think hopefully it's helpful as we've been talking. What I've kind of got this mental picture in my mind of how this sort of all works together, isn't it? It's a concerted campaign that started with people like Falwell Sr. and others, the Moral Majority, back in the late 70s and early 80s. We're seeing this all coming to fruition now. This evangelical fundamentalist base is still very much alive and well. And they're so into the political arena, and it's worldwide, isn't it? So people have to be really, really careful. They've got to educate themselves, as you say, and find out what the hell's going on. Because if you sit back and do nothing, you know, evil flourishes when good men do nothing. Isn't that what the quote says? Something like that.
Yeah. Absolutely. It's what James Comey, the FBI director who was fired by Trump, has called the silent circle of ascent. And that's what he has seen all around Donald Trump. And I think that's probably what scares him as much as anything out there right now.
And it's also the case that what we're dealing with now, we're dealing with a world of information and communication. And when that becomes sick, when that becomes poisonous, when that becomes something that is destructive, then what you have is something that goes in. It's like a virus. It's like a disease. That's why we call it information disease. And it's like that is so, so dangerous, because what we've been talking about, how do you then deprogram whole countries? How do you deprogram something that is that big and deep in that vast a way. See,
that's why we put Holy Terror was dealing with the fundamentalist movement and ideological fundamentalism, but a lot of that book was about the politics of the early 80s, and that's not in print right now. But when we put together the second edition of Snapping, we had combined all the really important material from our communication perspective on the fundamentalist model for controlling and recruiting and using communication controls, and also all the data from our information disease study. So it's all in one place, and it's something that hopefully remains a resource for people struggling with all these kinds of groups and movements now.
Yes, I've been reading the second edition of Snapping, as you recommended, which is very, very good. I'm about three quarters of the way through it. So it's proven to be a fantastic resource. And I'm glad, like you say, that you went back and actually updated it, because so much had happened. I think you talked about that in the introduction. When yes. the book came out, the Jonestown tragedy occurred just like 6 months later. But since then, you've had the Branch Davidian, the Waco tragedy, Heaven's mm-hmm. Gate, the Om Shinrikyo, and other right. destructive cult. There's been people that have been killed. And, you know, so there's a lot that's gone on. The world has radically changed. There was no such thing as the internet when, you know, Jonestown happened. So massive changes.
And that's also the changes also that are happening so fast. I think Jim alluded to it before, that people are not understanding. And like in the 70s and the 60s, children were looking to a new world then. They were looking for more. They were looking for new experiences. And that's what led them in their vulnerabilities. And when people were taking advantage of that. And today we have got even something bigger, because information is running in so many directions so fast. And the changes that are taking place, people just simply have not been educated for. They are not ready for these changes, and they don't know what to do. And the only thing they can do is take a deep breath, one step at a time, educate themselves, talk to the people. Yeah.
Pick up a copy of Snapping. Well, what are you two working on now? I don't want to keep you too long. I know we've been talking for about an hour, but this has been absolutely fascinating. I could talk to you for hours and hours, I'm sure. But what are you working on currently? Are you doing any more work in this area of politics and religion and sort of cult programming?
Well, as you might imagine, if you just pick up a newspaper or click onto the internet, we're having to deal with everything we've ever been dealing with all at once right now. We're continually updating our work and bringing forward the insights and the lessons from everybody's research on the cults, and all the insights that were gained, especially in terms of helping people leave these groups and take back control over their own minds. The last book we published was what we call a prequel to Snapping and Holy Terror. It was called Dark Hero of the Information Age, about Norbert Wiener, the founder of the science of cybernetics, which was the origins of our scientific understanding of communication and control. That's exactly how he defined his new science. And Wiener said way back in the late 1940s, when his book Cybernetics came out, he said the changes that are going to come from these new technologies are going to rapidly outstrip our human capacities to respond. And that's what we see as the root of so many of the problems today, when we say people do not have the tools to grasp the complexity of what's happening in the world around them, of the systems that even world leaders are in charge of. And you can't just fall for an easy answer or take some mm-hmm. absolute recipe for a living, because that's not going to help. And it's not going to help any of us if that's where people go.
It's too easy, isn't it? But it's those nice, trite, black and white platitudes. It sounds simple. It sounds easy. You know, I was talking to a guy we went down to Birmingham yesterday here in the UK. And we said goodbye to some friends. They're moving back to Canada. And one guy said, I don't know all this stuff about how trade works. I just go to the shop and I buy stuff off the shelf and I give the guy my money and I walk out. That's the extent of it. People above me are responsible for stocking the shelves, and I don't know where the food comes from, but it's not my problem, you know? And that's kind of it's funny, but it's the sort of the approach that you're describing, isn't it? It's like, hey, let's leave the higher ups to deal with the bigger problems. I'm just a person working here, and I'm just going to get along with my life as long as everything's, you know, I can do what I want to do. I can go down to the pub and have a pint with my mates from the neighborhood or whatever, then who cares, you know? Whatever happens to Brexit happens, or Trump or anything else. Of course, he's here in Britain right now, so there's a state visit going on. Well, how can people get a hold of you? That's my question, too, is what's the best way if people wanted to follow up and get some more resources? Do you have a website or social media contacts?
Yeah, you can go to stillpointpress.net, and you'll find the link there to Snapping, and to Holy Terror, and to the Dark Hero book that we published. They're all there, and people can email us there. But right now, we're kind of behind the curve because we have got a couple of new deadlines we're working on for hopefully some print and multimedia projects to try to continue the process of education. And as for your friend up in Birmingham, that's what we 60s people used to call a cop-out. That's not good enough in this day and age. Alan Turing, the great British computer scientist, he's the one who said everything is connected and everyone is connected today. Yeah. And people cannot just simply cop out and leave it to everyone else to do the thinking and to do the learning that's needed today.
They have to. And everybody today and every democracy has to stand up and be counted, because If you want to be able to go to the store and buy your goods, and you want to be free to just go down to the corner and have a pint, and you want to be free to do whatever you want to do, then you got to stand up and be counted. And in today's world, that means you don't have to understand every detail. But if the problems in your country, like, for example, some of the things that are going to befall the British people, if a hard Brexit goes forward and under somebody like Johnson, then it's like it really behooves you to understand what trade means. What does it generally mean in relation to your trade with other nations today, especially? And it's like to be conscious of these larger problems and the fact that even though you're one individual, we're all one individual, but we all make up our democracies. And so therefore, we count, and we have to make ourselves count by keeping ourselves informed.
Man, you are very passionate about that, Flo. I can feel the passion in your voice. But you're absolutely right, because the fact is, for my friend going to the store, that really doesn't work, because most of the products on the shelf aren't made here in Britain. They've been imported in from, a lot of it's from the EU.
Exactly.
It came across a border, which is probably, it's going to be a port, because we're an island nation, and that brings up a whole nother problem when and if Brexit is triggered. What are they going to do about importing, right? Export? I mean, that just isn't going to work to just say, well, hey, what do I care? Someone higher up is responsible. It's not my problem. Well, what happens when you go to the store and there's nothing on the shelves, you know? Whoops. What do I do now? We're in the shit now. Yes. Yeah, so.
And it's something we've been watching, and we're not over there, so we don't have as much detail as everyone in the UK does and hopefully has access to. But we've been watching from the beginning, just like the way Putin and his internet research agency spent, you know, millions and made tens of millions of fake messages to influence our election. There's quite a bit of evidence that he targeted the Brexit movement because his goal more than anything is to break up Europe, neutralize the West, and especially to destroy the supremacy in so many arenas of England and the Anglo-American world and Anglo-American community. So if he can break up the UK and he can effectively take control with a puppet here in the US, he's laughing. He's got everything he wants. I'm surprised, yeah, that we haven't seen more investigation in the UK into the exact nature of the disinformation that went into the Brexit campaign.
Absolutely, yeah. Because we know, for example, that Cambridge Analytica, which is a British company, they were involved both in the Brexit campaign as well as the Trump election.
That's
in harvesting data from companies like Facebook and Twitter to influence people in both countries to vote to leave Brexit and to vote for Donald Trump and against Hillary Clinton. So absolutely. And they know that the Russians were behind a lot of that. Of course, Trump denies all that, but yeah, he's doing Putin's bidding, isn't he? Because he's trying to break up former allies like Germany and Canada, Mexico. He's picking fights with everybody, right. And if we leave the EU, which we're probably going to, he's won another battle to destabilize not only Europe but the rest of the world. So there's some really scary stuff coming down the pipeline. People need to be aware of.
And they really, we would beseech you to focus on the communication dimensions. What we say, not matter and energy, it's information and communication.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it's invisible. It's invisible, but those dynamics can be understood. And if you dig a little bit and you think critically and you view the media critically, then you can see where this information, misinformation, and disinformation is being used to manipulate and control enormous populations. And the consequences couldn't be higher for all of us.
Well, you know, my passion comes from the fact that Communication science was what I did in my doctoral work at the University of Oregon, no less. The fact is that human communication is something that is more vital today. And the organic nature of the bond between all human beings is being blasted asunder. And you can see it and how it's being chipped away, and causing devastating things in every nation now. And it is because of communication being used and poisoned, and information being poisoned.
We interviewed a guy maybe 20 years ago who was on the cutting edge of the technology in Silicon Valley. And what he was bemoaning was the lack of human bonds and connections in that transient place where people were moving from job to job and company to company. He said, the bonds that make and keep us human are the relationships we have with one another. And if we lose those bonds, I think we lose the element of our humanity. And that's why we're looking at the invisible dynamics of the information and communication that is really ruling the world today.
Well, I'm so glad that we've been able to have this conversation. That's exactly what it's about, isn't it? Ultimately, it is communication.
Yes.
We're hearing your voices coming across, and we're having a discussion. But it's more than that, isn't it? It's getting the word out, as you were saying, helping people to kind of go, whoa, I need to wake up here and figure out what the hell's going on, how I'm being controlled, how I'm being manipulated, whether it's the media or religion or somehow a combination of both of those. So I really applaud you both for the work that you've done going way back to the 80s and all the way through, keeping abreast of what's going on. And you're still doing a lot of work, it sounds like.
Well, it's really ultimately, you know, I would not like to see humanity disappear. Or the long progress the human beings have made, you know, and the enterprise of knowledge that has kept things moving forward, you know. Or I would not like to see democracies disappear, even if Mr. Putin wants it to happen. So in order for that and all those things not to happen, we have to now confront our world today, and it is one of communication and information. And we have to educate ourselves on exactly how we're taking all that in and what's happening.
Absolutely. And I appreciate, you, like I say, your voices. So pick up a copy of Snapping, second edition. If you go back to the first one, it's going to be from 1978, I think. So it's good information, but it's a little bit out of date. So listen, thank you, Flo and Jim. You guys have been absolutely fantastic. I would love to keep in touch with you and find out what you're doing. I'll put a link to your website in the show notes, so if listeners want to get a hold of you or at least, you know, read what you're doing, there's a way to do that. So thank you so much for being just absolutely fantastic guests. I've been looking forward to this conversation for at least a few weeks since we've been emailing back and forth. So thank you so much for being great guests.
It's been a pleasure, Clint. I hope we haven't talked your head off.
Oh, no. Absolutely loved it. I could talk for another hour. So, you know, if you're up for doing another podcast in 6 months, I'll hit you up again and we'll figure out what's changed since we talked the last time.
That would be interesting.
And
thank you. And thank you for your very wonderful piece that you wrote about Trump and the cult of personality and all of it. And please keep up this good work. We feel the same way about what you're doing. So
well, we
thank
have
you.
Kindred spirits then.
Yes.
If I'm ever in New York, I'll stop by. If you're ever in North Wales, you can come see me and we'll have a pint and we'll put the world to rights, as they say here in Britain.
Is that where you are, North Wales?
Yeah, we're in North Wales. We're up near Liverpool.
Oh, you near Llandudno and Conwy?
Yeah, we're about 45 minutes from those areas. Yep. Oh. We're near Wrexham, which is not too far.
I told Flo Conway that I'm going to have to take her to her castle and show her her castle there one day.
I'll tell you what, you come stay with us and I'll take you to Conway Castle and we'll have a pint. There's a beautiful restaurant there that I know. So we'll hook you up. I guarantee we'll hook you up.
All right. I'm ready.
Does that sound like a deal? Yeah. Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Talk to you later then. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Take care.
You know what really struck me as I was going back and listening to this episode, as I was editing it and putting it all together, some of the stuff that both Flo and Jim were talking about, and I want to relate it right into the kind of cult-like background that I came out of. I've talked about this in other shows, and as I mentioned, I went into it in some detail on the recent episode of Chris Shelton's Sensibly Speaking podcast, talking about my story growing up in the Gothard cult, the Bill Gothard Institute in Basic Youth Conflicts, as it was called then. But you know, something that I think it was Jim that talked about it, the markers of what goes on in evangelical or fundamentalist Christianity, this idea of surrendering your will, thought-stopping techniques. And of course, I've talked about Christianese and the mystical manipulation that goes on in many a church, thinking that it's all somehow free-flowing and in the spirit, but it's actually carefully controlled by the higher-ups. And something that they're very good at is implanting phobias, the fear of Satan, the fear of hell, losing your salvation, or just losing the relationships that you have with the people that you have built relationships within the church or the community. That's what it's all about. And this leads to what they talked about, the information disease, specifically as it relates to the evangelical or Pentecostal charismatic experience. All this indoctrination, the teaching that you hear week in and week out, you're part of this church cult bubble thing, you know, speaking in tongues, the chanting, the prayers, hearing all these sermons, the loaded language, loaded with the ideology of the group. Jim said, you know, this idea that the devil is a doubt bringer, bringing this, these information controls, these internal information controls. And this is what this information disease is all about. It's actually doing organic damage to your brain, and it takes a long time to recover. And of course, you put in all the sacred science, you know, the Bible is inspired, it's inerrant, it's infallible, it's authoritative, blah, blah, blah. Well, this is a culture that is rife for abuse and control. And we see this right across evangelicalism, even into mainstream churches, you know. So just looking at evangelicalism and charismatic type churches, even mainline mainstream churches, all these things can apply. You could tick off the boxes and probably add more of them. And I've talked about that in my show, the one I did on Is Evangelicalism a Cult? The Psychology of Conversion. Some of those other ones that I talked about specifically relating what cult experts, psychologists, sociologists have picked up on in mainstream cults, and I've related them into the church. And now you take that and go, okay, that's in the microcosm, as it were, of the individual local church. There's a lot of religious trauma and abuse that goes on. People are hurt, people are damaged, and they need to recover from that. But then what Jim said is, on the microcosm, what cults are doing or churches are doing, that's just one thing. But on the macro level, what the fundamentalists started back in the early 80s or even going back to the late 70s is the same trajectory that we're seeing today on a macro level in terms of how they use and abuse information and their goals, you know, taking over a political party, taking over the House and the Senate, taking over the White House, taking over the Supreme Court, all those things. That was their agenda back in 1980, the moral majority, the religious right. These are the same things, the same sort of playbook, things that are going on right now today. So we have to be extremely cautious, extremely careful. Is this the last gasp of evangelicalism? Is this just the pendulum swing? Or is this something that is leading us into sort of a Handmaid's Tale type scenario? So there's a lot of stuff. You got to be careful. You got to read. You got to educate yourself. As we've said in many other shows, education is critically important. So there's a lot of good stuff. If you want to contact me, I can put you in touch with some of the information that I've studied and read myself that's helpful to me. You can follow me on Twitter at MindShift2018. I will also put links to Conway and Siegelman's website in the show notes. If you want to find out what else, other books and other things that they're working on, you can look at their website. That's a good way to kind of get to know what they're doing. And also then, what's happening in the next couple of weeks? Well, I've got an interview in 2 weeks coming up with Natalie Hoffman. We're going to be talking about how people can escape abusive, emotionally abusive, controlling relationships. Now, in her experience and her kind of coming out of that herself, she now helps people do the same thing. She's got an organization that helps people do that. And there's a lot of parallels to that and the world of the cults. And that's why I was really interested to talk to Natalie, because if you read, for example, Yanya Lalich's and Tobias's book, Take Back Your Life, it's subtitled Recovering from Cults and Abusive Relationships. And they talk about in the book how people, and unfortunately it happens to be in many cases women, a lot of the times are trapped in abusive relationships that is emotionally abusive, although certainly men can be trapped in it as well. But the ones that Natalie deals with are primarily women. So we're going to be talking talking about how can you get out, what resources are available once you do get out of that abusive, controlling relationship, and what the correlations are between the mind control, the you know, sort of breaching of informed consent, and all these things that happen in cults, they also happen in emotionally abusive relationships. So that's going to be a really fascinating discussion with Natalie Hoffman coming up in a couple of weeks. Also, I'm just going to mention real quick that in July, I'm going to be going over to the States. We're going to be doing an ex-evangelical gathering on the 6th of July in the Seattle area. We're going out for dinner. And so if you're interested in that, you can let me know. Get a hold of me and I'll get you in touch with all the details as far as where it's going to be, what time, and so forth. I'm also going to be doing a show with Neil 604, the Canadian atheist, the next weekend up in Canada. We're going to be meeting for lunch in the New Westminster area of Vancouver, BC. So if you're in that area or up in the Pacific Northwest, you can come up and meet us for lunch at the pub. And then later you can check out, tune in to Neil 604's YouTube channel. And we're going to be, I guess, co-hosting the show. Unfortunately, there won't be any room for a live audience. That's what we were hoping to do, but we couldn't find a venue to fit everybody in. So if you can jump on Neil 604's YouTube channel, you can catch us there on the Saturday night. I think it starts 6 p.m. West Coast time. So check that out coming up on the 13th of July. All right, I'll catch you in a couple of weeks with Natalie Hoffman as we talk about escaping emotionally abusive relationships. Thanks for tuning in. I've been your host, Dr. Clint Haycock. I'll catch you on the next episode right here on Mind Shift Podcast.